Hello, and welcome to the latest edition of the FT Advisor podcast. It seems that nothing much can be done to stop the steamroller that is consolidation in the wealth and financial advice markets. Pandemics, rising interest rates, inflation seem to have done little to stop asset managers, wealth managers, financial advisors from buying each other up in a bid for more scale. But is this likely to continue? And what will the wealth market look like in 5 years' time or so? I'm Damien Fantato, Deputy Editor of FT Advisor. And with me to discuss this are Alberta Charles, UK Asset and Wealth Management Leader at PwC, and Louise Jeffries, Managing Director of Gunn & Co. Hello both.
Morning.
Hi, morning.
Good morning. So, as I mentioned in my intro, we're now well into a world of higher rates and inflation. Alberta, how has this affected M&A activity, if at all?
Well, interestingly, so if you look at what's happening in the broader asset management sector, as well as wealth management, I think there are a number of fundamental factors that are that have been disrupting those sectors. And it's really making the need to scale up via M&A an imperative for those businesses. So you had factors like, you know, higher cost pressures from regulatory burdens getting higher, rapid digital transformation, and for the wealth sector in particular, really accelerating a shift in what customers need. Yeah. And so a number of players are now also seeing fee pressures coming through the wealth management sector in a way that it hadn't, you know, so the fees had sort of held up much better than what we'd seen in asset management. But the increase in demand for passive investing and index-linked investing is bringing that fee pressure into the wealth management sector as well. So you've got fee pressure coming through, you've got pressure on costs. And so there's really starting to be a squeeze on margins that's driving the need to scale up by buying smaller players to deliver synergies and cost savings.
And Louise, how does that reflect what you're, I suppose, seeing on the ground in terms of M&A activity and the deals that you're doing?
Yeah, absolutely. I completely agree with Alberta. We're definitely seeing that, you know, the players in the market, particularly in the wealth management market, which is where we specialize, they can see that there is a big opportunity as they go through vertical integration, as they look at the value chain of a client. They can see that through consolidating and buying up these smaller owner-operator businesses, not only will it then future-proof their businesses from the pressures, the regulatory pressures, as Alberta mentioned, but also give them the opportunity to maximize those returns through looking at the value chain, looking at the other elements of the service cycle that they can offer that smaller players can't.
And I think linked to that is one of the reasons why it's such an attractive segment, right, for private equity. So, you know, talking about the wealth management sector in particular, Louise talked about the opportunities to create value from vertical integration, but it's also a sector that offers predictable recurring revenues, and it's still highly fragmented as well, right? So I believe probably the top 30 wealth managers cover about 50% of the advisors in the market, and you've got a really long tail of about another 5,000 or so subscale and often advice only players, which, as Louise mentioned, can then be rolled up through consolidation. So it's a really attractive business model from a private equity perspective. And there are a number of private equity players that are backing consolidators. And so I think the deal activity is going to continue for some time.
And sorry, go on.
Just to add to that, because I was thinking about this actually this morning, Alberta, because I can, you know, we obviously have a lot of private equity sort of knocking on our door saying, you know, can we get a platform business from which to roll up, to grow? And if you think about it like a subscription business and you look at the boom of subscription businesses, particularly on the consumer side now, and you look at something like Harry's Razors or all of these subscription models, and then you play and you think about who is investing in these companies, and then you play that out from a financial planning and wealth management profession. As Roberta said, the money is stable. The amount of opportunity for consolidation is there. The profitability in these businesses is huge. The cost per acquisition of new clients in generally in the owner managed sector especially is very low. So when you're an investor and you're looking at you know, where am I going to go into in terms of getting a return? It's a fantastic opportunity. Mm-hmm.
I just want to pick up on this issue of private equity that you've both raised. There have been a lot of private equity players move into this space. That seems to, at least from my anecdotal experience, slowed down a little bit in the last year and a bit, year or so maybe. Is that just because there's already a lot of active private equity players in this market, or has maybe the interest rate environment made it a little bit less attractive? Is that, or maybe I'm wrong, maybe my anecdotal experience is a bit wrong.
I mean, my feeling is definitely that the competitiveness now in the sector is leading smaller, particularly small cap private equity that want to come in and start a consolidation journey. I think that, and certainly conversations that I've had with some of these companies, is that they're a bit too late. And I definitely think, you know, we're talking now almost 4 years ago, where I would say we started the realm of startup consolidators, private equity backed startup consolidators that came in with nothing, with purely a strategic plan of growth through acquisition. And it's a very competitive market for those companies. They're competing with one another with quite similar value propositions for the business sellers. And so, at least from a similarly anecdotal experience, I think that they're just a bit too late now, and that's why they're not coming in.
Yeah, I think you're right. But also, because you've had this wave of consolidation and you have now built, I suppose, a number of businesses, take the vertically integrated consolidators. The question is, how much of the value creation opportunities within that have they really realized? And there's almost a question as to whether you should start to see some consolidation at that level. And I think a number of private equity investors who have gone into the sector are probably at that stage where they're reflecting on the next stage of value creation, which is potentially starting to create consolidation at the top end with the vertically integrated consolidators.
Mm-hmm. I'm 100% expecting to see that in the next 2 years, particularly with the new consolidators that came in the last 4 years. You know, they will all have had significant targets. And as we sit and in our world, so bringing buyers and sellers together, we're bringing very similar buyers to, you know, the same seller, and they're competing against each other. So they're finding it very difficult to reach those targets.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you've both mentioned vertical integration a couple of times. To what extent is M&A activity still being driven by a desire to achieve that? You know, I'm an asset manager. I want to own a platform. I want to own an advice business, rather than I'm a wealth manager. I just want more wealth managers so that I can get more and more scale.
I think we're certainly still working with players, both financial and strategic, who are doing both. So if you look at the lower end of the market, probably with assets around $1 billion, I think in that market, it's very difficult for players looking to scale up, because if you've got a fully integrated, vertically integrated player, they've got efficiencies, synergies that they can bring into play and share with the seller. And so I think they're always going to be at the front of the queue. And there is still some value to be had, as I said, from that long tail. So I think mass consolidation of the advice-only play, I think there's still some way to run with that. And I also think that in terms of the broader value creation opportunities beyond sort of vertical integration, it's companies are also looking at opportunities to broaden the product and service capabilities that they have, because one of the things that customers are saying is we want much broader, more personalized service to us. And a lot of the players that we are looking at the moment sometimes tend to be quite narrow in what we're getting. So I think there is still a lot of M&A that is focusing much more narrow on buying capability, broadening product ranges. So I think the reason and for consolidation and scaling up, it's not just about costs and savings. It's about talent. I think the bigger you are, the more attractive you are to retain and attract talent. It's about product. It's about entering new markets. So there's still, I think, some way to go. Mm-hmm.
Louise, what do you think?
Yeah, I think what we see is on the buy side, there is it's very common for there to be at least a couple of revenue opportunities or value opportunities from on the buy side from multiple value chain elements. So whether it's having integrated investment management, DFM permissions, those sorts of things. Although I do think conversely, we see a lot of sellers who typically, if you're talking again, those subscale owner-managed businesses who do not have those capabilities in the house and are often quite wary of selling into the bigger players. And in fact, often, you know, that sort of culture crisis of trying to sell something really quite small into something really quite big, where the business seller has probably a bit more power because they're actually the one making a decision in a very competitive environment. So where normally you would say, okay, well, you know, the big guy's got all of the decision-making power, all of the sort of negotiation power, but actually if they want to have this mass roll-up, this mass consolidation, and they're working with very idiosyncratic owner managers, we see that actually some of those more sophisticated businesses that on paper look like they're much more better run, talented people, they can be quite intimidating for on the sell side. And so we see that smaller pure play financial planning regional businesses can actually win out in those competitive environments.
I suppose we've touched on this a little bit up till now, but I was wondering if I could just ask you both to sort of sketch out a little bit, what do you think is the profile of company that's most likely to be most acquisitive over the next few years, and what's the profile of the company is that's most likely to be acquired, who's most likely to be predator and prey, I suppose. Alberto, what do you think?
I think that who is likely to be predator, I think, is closely linked with who is well positioned to succeed in the longer term. And I think there are a number of attributes around that. So I think it's those players who have a really clear USP. So being very clear on whether you're a technology play, advice-only play, or you're a fully integrated, vertically integrated consolidator, and really doing that at scale. Because of the margin pressures, I think scale is really critical. And with the right tech and the right talent. And so I think that doesn't always mean, you know, building your own tech. It's the players that recognize that, you know, you have a USP and you can borrow, enter into alliances, partnerships to power you in the areas where you haven't got a particular strength or core capability. And we're seeing a number of players doing that. So we've got fully vertically integrated players, but they're actually using, you know, often white labeled platforms that they brand as their own. So I think that's really critical. The other aspect I think which would be really important in terms of who is going to be coming out on top is customer profiling. So I think players that are really embracing technology, including AI, to really enhance their customer profiling, I think would be mm-hmm. critical for the future, because one of the studies we did showed that 66% of high net worth investors are dissatisfied with the level of personalized service they're getting from their advisors. 46% said that they were either going to make a change or already made a change in their advisor relationships in the next 12 to 24 months. And so really focusing on using technology, AI, to really enhance customer profiling, making sure you have multi-channel engagement, particularly as the sector prepares for the unprecedented wealth transfer we're seeing. I think $68 trillion being transferred from baby boomers to millennials. And so millennials, as you know, much more purpose-driven, much more focused around climate, ESG, and therefore having sort of virtual, and they are very tech first, right? In terms of very comfortable with engaging digitally. So enhanced customer profiling with sort of multiple channel engagement, personalized customer experiences, virtual collaboration tools. I think that's quite important part of a successful player going forward.
Louise, what do you think?
I think I completely agree with Alberta. I think the one thing that you said that really stuck out for me was that point around unique selling proposition or USP, because as I said, from my experience, when I sit in on, you know, many, many meetings of buyer meet seller, you know, dating, first dates, and we're seeing that Mr. Buyer is saying the same thing as every other Mr. Buyer. And I think that then from a selling perspective and putting yourself in the seller's mindset, it's very difficult to differentiate and really make a good decision on what's the next best home for your clients and your team and your staff. So I think those areas where you start to see the larger players have significant differentiation and specific differentiation will help them to stand out. I do think the thing that perhaps we mustn't forget as well, though, is that, and I used the term in my last comment, but the sellers in these subscale, and I'm talking sort of half a billion under management and below, these subscale businesses, they are very idiosyncratic. And so when we're in this first date environment, there is quite a big element of how much do I actually like the person on the other side of the table and how much can I build trust? And as Alberta said, you know, all of those elements of having a successful, future-proofed business are 100% necessary, but they're not necessarily going to be all the things I think that will win them the deals in the M&A market. And I think one of the things, as I mentioned before, is the balance between the level of change any clients and team members will see through that transition period and through that acquisition journey. Because Mr. Seller is sitting there hoping that nothing will change. And of course, the buy side want to bring those clients into a new realm of financial planning. And I think it's getting that balance right. And it's a much longer term journey than just the process of selling the business or the transition process.
And on that topic, briefly, we've seen valuations go up and up. Do you think do you have any reason to think that's likely to change, Louise?
So we analysed the first 6 months of the offers that we've seen across businesses in the wealth management sector and financial planning specific sector, and we have seen that on the recurring income side, which is very typically used for really subscale businesses, we're talking sort of sub 100 million under management, typically single advisor firms, retiree profile firms, we're seeing pressure now for the first time on those valuations. So we quoted that full year last year, we were at an average of 4x recurring income, and looking at the first 6 months of this year at 3.5x. And anecdotally, we're very much hearing on the buy side that there's less interest in these smaller firms. We're very much hearing that these buyers, and as I mentioned, there's a significant amount of competition amongst these buyers. And so they're looking for acquisitions which are going to move the dial. They're looking for bigger acquisitions. And so, you know, conversely on that same theme, when we look at an analysed deals based on adjusted profit, which is much more likely to be a multi-advisor firm, buying a full business, we have seen growth. We've seen that grow from 8x to 8.3x. And I think the competitiveness in that sector, in that segment, will continue to drive that. But I do think that there's pressure. Some of it's certainly coming from debt costs, interest rate rises, but there is pressure in the smaller advice firm sales.
Mm. Alberta, do you have any thoughts on that?
So I'd say I suppose the other end of the deal spectrum, where we tend to do a lot more of our deal support, we're still seeing pricing holding up. So for businesses that, as I said, offer, you know, a real opportunity to enhance the value creation of those consolidators. So whether it be a fully vertically integrated consolidator that wants to get this advice-only business that they can then roll up onto their platforms and to their products. For the good businesses and probably the more sizable ones, we're still seeing that pricing hasn't really softened a lot.
Looking forward 5 years or so, what do you think the wealth market will look like in terms of in terms of the companies that operate in it, Alberta?
I mean, we've just done a recent survey of the asset and wealth management sector, where we talked to 250 managers and 250 investors. And we expect to see, based on the disruption that's going on in the market, the drive for consolidation and for scaling up, we expect to see a significant level of shakeout in the market at higher rates than what we've seen historically. So our analysis suggests that we will see 1 in 6 asset and wealth managers globally potentially taken over in one shape or another. We expect to see sort of the top players take a significantly higher share of AUM. So currently, if you look at the global market, top 10 largest asset managers have just about 42.5% in 2020. And our analysis suggests by 2027, they will increase their share to just under half. Mm-hmm. So we see concentration around the big 10. And the other key elements is around AI and disruptive tech. So currently, a significant proportion of asset managers are embracing AI. And in wealth management space, I think there are significant opportunities for that to really transform a number of aspects of the value chain. So if you look at client onboarding, for example, I think you can have really effective, like AI chatbots, AI-based solutions that really are much better at risk assessment and client profiling. And so you can get a really better understanding of dimensions around risk, return, liquidity, time horizon, portfolio fit, ESG, all of the stuff that's really important for millennials. And so I think we'll see AI and disruptive tech really transforming the operations for businesses. But really for wealth management, I think what it will do is free up advisor capacity away from all the admin and really free up the time to spend with customers who are saying they want more customized experience. So freeing up time from admin to spend much more on building customer relationships and growing, I suppose, your customer base.
Mm-hmm. And do you see that, think that there's anything that could derail that? If anything is likely to derail that, what might it be, I suppose?
I think, as Louise mentioned, it's whatever changes you're trying to make in the wealth management sector, it's how do you get your advisors on board? Mm-hmm. And if you think about, Louise, I think you described them as, you know, the advisor owner businesses. Culturally, are they ready to make the transition at the pace and scale that the larger consolidators are looking and need to drive to retain the margins and drive, you know, the value they want to achieve from their M&A strategy. Mm-hmm. So I think there's a question around the culture and how much time and effort you put in to making sure that you get your advisors on board with any changes you want to make.
Louise, what do you think the market will look like in about 5 years or so in terms of the companies that will be still around?
Yeah, I mean, maybe just starting with a bit of run on from where Alberta was, because one of the things I do wonder in the larger consolidators, and so in terms of how well I know those companies, I know those companies from the perspective of watching them pitch to business owners that they're hoping, obviously, to buy their businesses. And I don't hear a lot of talk about their technology plans and their embracing of AI. And to Alberta's point, and I've wondered this for a while, when you look at these millennials coming in with very different needs from the current baby boomer client base, but then you look at these private equity backed companies that are on quite short term investment time horizons, and you've got investors who are, I would say, possibly looking at a market where there's a huge amount of quick opportunity to grow through acquisition and to spend money there versus spending the money on all of that, all of those tech play, tech first, thinking about what the millennials want. And I don't know, I actually wonder if I can just push the question over, or not push the question, but to pose a question to Alberta, who's working closer with some of those big players, to say, are they actually embracing all of this technology now? Because I don't see them presenting it, if I'm honest. Hopefully they are my clients, but I don't see that coming across in the presentations that I'm seeing.
I think that's quite interesting, isn't it, in terms of them not selling it. From what we see with the clients we're working on, that the tech, AI, big data, that's a really big focus in terms of value creation, the whole value creation thesis for the next phase of, I think perhaps the first phase was all about building the scale. And therefore I can understand why in the conversations that you sat in, why that wasn't the top priority in those pitches. But given where the market has come and the level of consolidation that has happened, I think the next stage is very much around how you deliver on the cost synergies, and technology is certainly very central to that from what we can see.
I'm very glad to hear it.
But having said that, I'm not sure that I would say that the wealth management sector is as advanced as what we see in the broader asset management sector. And so our research showed that 90% of asset managers globally already using disruptive technology tools like big data, like AI, like blockchain to enhance their investment performance. I am not sure that the wealth management sector is as advanced as the broader asset management sectors in that regard.
I mean, I wonder in terms of talking about, if we think about consolidation of firms, and if we think about the volumes of directly authorized firms that are in the market today, our analysis suggests that that has broadly stayed constant. So whilst we see businesses being consolidated, we also then see startups and new directly authorized businesses, businesses that might have been appointed representatives becoming directly authorized businesses. And so whilst I completely agree with Alberta that I think that the consolidators will naturally get bigger, I think that there remains the opportunity and there remains the momentum of new directly authorized businesses coming in. And I wonder if we will see new younger owner managers coming in with a much better understanding of the millennial clients, replacing some of those consolidated retiree businesses. And then the question comes in of where does the client fit? Because the consolidated, the retired businesses are selling their businesses into the large consolidator. The younger new startups are coming in with no clients, but there is the value, the passing on of the wealth. And so whether then I think that the large businesses will start to lose clients, if they aren't as quick as, like you're saying, Alberta, in the wealth management sector, if they aren't as quick to embrace direct consumer trends of technology and things like that. And I think that then the competition for the client outside of the competition for the M&A side will probably heat up.
Okay, well, thanks very much to both of you for taking part and for your insight. That was really interesting. And thank you for listening. And this was the last edition of the FT Advisor podcast for the summer. We'll be back in September, in early September. So have a good summer. And thank you very much for tuning in. And tune into the next edition of the FT Advisor podcast. Thank you.
Welcome to Sincerely Sloan, presented by Uninterrupted. I'm your host, professional tennis player, wife, parent, and entrepreneur, Sloan Stevens. As an athlete and as a person, my journey has had a lot of twists and turns, from moments of adversity and doubt to unimaginable triumph and satisfaction. Throughout the season, I'm joined by some of the biggest names in sports, entertainment, culture, and a few members of my tribe. Our conversations keep it real and push it past skin deep. We reveal the perspectives, routines, and products that allow each of us to show up at our best. Join me on my journey of self-discovery and many, many laughs along the way. Sincerely, Sloan.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers. With rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com. Code PROGRAM.